Anyway, good morning, everybody, and it's nice to see all the diehard cases here. Quite a few of whom I recognize as diehard cases. It's Saturday. We really shouldn't be here, but it's good to see you. What I'm going to talk about is something I've been working on and off for a decade or so, and the broader theme is we have all these wonderful results in mathematical statistics, and the other theme is none of this is affecting our teaching very much, or what we actually bring out to our graduate students even at the early stages. So this got me interested, and what I'm talking about, technically speaking, is penalized least squares with many quadratic penalties, or not many, a handful of quadratic penalties for the problem of estimating a large multi-way arrays. Okay, so it's a classical problem, it's regression basically. And the question is, what does modern mathematical statistics bring to the regression scenario besides classical least squares or various ad hoc smoothing technologies or whatever? So there are many issues, and I'm going to try to get into them here. Obviously not all of them, but I just want to bring them up to attention. So the background we face these days is that we are living in the age of the algorithm, and I think everybody perceives this. You can't even buy groceries these days without having your purchase entered into a database somewhere, which will be dutifully analyzed by somebody, probably ineptly, because they don't have good ways yet. But yeah, that's the direction we're going in. The interesting thing is that, of course, mathematical logicians really got this going about a century ago. The attempt to put mathematics on a firm logical foundation had some unexpected consequences. And you wouldn't expect that guys working on Gödel's theorem or whatever would actually be influencing what happens in the supermarket, but that's basically what's happened. So in the early 20th century, people tried to make rigorous the ancient concept of an algorithm, and I've given an account here that's a popular description of it, which is quite good. David Berlinski wrote a book around 2000 called The Advent of the Algorithm. It's a popular book. What makes it interesting to read is that he happens to have a PhD in mathematical logic from Princeton, so his account is careful. And the development of the algorithmic idea in the 20th century, of course, led to computers in particular, which in turn enable us to implement algorithms. And so the talks we've heard already in this workshop have really showed us how that's being done. It's a very active theme. I'd like to point out that Marshall McLuhan, who was a professor at the U of T and was born 100 years ago this year, perceived where things were going in a book he wrote in 1964 called Understanding Media. I was an undergrad then, so I actually read the book. And what he pointed out is that technology provides an environment within which humans think, and the way they think and the things they do is shaped by the technological environment. And so we need to be conscious that algorithms and the ability to implement algorithms on computing are actually shaping what we do in statistics. Okay, and that's beginning to happen, I think. It's not just writing code. You have to understand the whole thought process is being affected. Now, the specific area I'm going to be talking about is a k-way layout of observations. And so there's k covariates and a univariate response, and there's measurement error. And I just want to estimate mean responses. And the layout may be complete or incomplete, balanced or unbalanced. In regression scenarios, it's usually incomplete in the sense that we do not have data at all k-fold combinations of the covariate values. Okay, but in classical ANOVA, we often have complete layouts, and they're often balanced because the mathematics becomes simpler then. And if they're not, well, we cope with it anyway. So I'm talking about the problem of regression, which amounts to estimating means that depend on k-covariates. And I don't want to assume too much. I'm not going to plop down some model gratuitously. I'm going to assume the means are unknown and leave it at that. Okay, so the number of means, the number of covariate value combinations that we get could be large. Before I jump into that, I'd like to remind myself and others that we have a range of statistical ideas that have been developing over the past century. And for a start, we have the use of probability models in statistics. At one extreme, we have no probability models in data analysis in the style of John Tukey, say. And then we can have fixed effects models where we have some randomness present in measurement errors, and that'll be the scenario I'll be mostly discussing. Then we have random effects models, and then we have Bayesian notions of randomness in our modeling. And they're all different mathematically, and, you know, it's to be remembered. It's not a casual decision to go from one to the other. You are making assumptions about the world that may or may not be justifiable in any real sense. Because of these different scenarios, we actually increasingly distinguish among data, on the one hand, which is not certifiably random, typically. We don't know how to generate random variables. We can do pseudo-random numbers. They have some of the properties of random variables in probability theory, but not very many. That was explored in the 60s by various people. Kolmogorov and Donald Knuth both contributed there, and many others since then. So, you know, you can't confuse data with random variables, actually. That's intellectually dishonest. What you can do is think of a probability model as a mechanism for generating pseudo-data, fake data, on which you can test your procedures. That's honest. And that's basically what we do with mathematical statistics based on probability. We're seeing how statistical procedures behave on fake data that we hope is somewhat pertinent to the kind of data we actually will be analyzing. And pseudo-random numbers and simulations, same deal here. There's no reason to think that our data is pseudo-random either. But again, it's a way of generating fake data on which we can explore what procedures do. And finally, of course, we have algorithms, which statisticians might call as fully realized procedures. That is to say, we have a complete way of describing how to do the thing, and we can actually implement it. So that's one sort of range of ideas. There's the other idea that we've seen quite a bit of already in the workshop, that you don't really want to do anything beyond the simplest fit that seems reasonable. And people have been trying to make this precise for a long time, and there are various mathematical formulations of this, such as bias variance trade-off and use of sparse bases and so forth. And the last point I'd like to make here is that statistics is actually undergoing an evolution. Statistics is not just mathematical statistics. It's not just any of these subsets of enterprises, data analysis, pseudo-random numbers, and so forth. It's actually a very large field which has these various components in it. And one of the flaws of our field, I think, has been not to popularize this actual fact that we are confused sometimes with mathematicians because people see the mathematical statistics. They don't realize there's a broader context of statistics within which mathematical statistics contributes. The analogy I like is with modern scientific medicine. I mean, if you think about it, when you go to a physician to be treated for something, you hope there's some scientific understanding, some theoretical understanding of the procedure that's being applied to you. You also hope that the understanding is a bit deeper than just theoretical. You know, you don't want to be the first subject for some new surgical procedure just because some theory said this was a good thing. So in medicine, for good reason, we have this evolution and this multiple way of assessing surgical procedures. We have the theoretical understanding these days from molecular biology or whatever. We have the experiments on the lab rats and chimpanzees and so forth. We have clinical trials. And best of all, eventually, we have the result of long-run studies on people who have been treated this way. And I think statistics, ideally, is headed in a similar direction. We will have a multitudinous system for evaluating whether a statistical procedure is any good on data. Data plays the role of the patient here. And, you know, it's not a theoretical construct. It's out there in the real world. Okay, science has had a long series of evolutionary steps. I just want to draw attention here briefly to Free. Peter Peregrinus was a French scholar and soldier who investigated magnetism in the 1200s while on campaign in France. You know, he had evenings to kill, and instead of drinking beer, he investigated the ideas like magnetism. His work was suppressed eventually because the papacy got a little aggressive about science in the 1300s, but Gilbert rediscovered it in the 1500s and did more. Roger Bacon was another early figure, and he knew Peter Peregrinus. And that's basically where the distinction between theory and experiment first was enunciated clearly in Europe. Okay. And then we have Occam's razor, which is actually quite hard to find in his writing. The closest version, I mean, the simple version is keep it simple. The closest to what you can find in his writing is this quotation in the middle of transparency, and it's pretty close to what most people think of. So this is actual written statement of Occam's razor by Occam. And then we have a very interesting quote by Andrei Kolmogorov in 1963, you know, about 30 years or so after he published his famous little book on the axioms of probability and their consequences. He said, it's not entirely clear the probability theory is applicable to the real world. Okay, and that was part of what motivated his work on what we now call Kolmogorov complexity and, you know, the whole school of thought there. So we're not the only ones who are puzzled about the fact that the real world doesn't follow theory necessarily. Okay, so I am going to be talking about theory, but I want to put it in the context of the other stuff. The theory is just one aspect of the whole business here. So I'm going to be looking at fairly classical ways of looking at estimating means in multi-way layouts, starting with least squares fits, and then working our way on through basically penalized fits. And what I'm going to try to argue is that the penalization technique has a lot more life left in it than people generally think, even with quadratic penalties. And that's the only case I'll be looking at. Because you can do several quadratic penalties. How you design the penalties matters. How you pick the penalty weights matters. And all these things are susceptible to analysis. And I'll be, you know, giving some cases where we can analyze. The broad idea is, of course, regularization. All of these are special instances of that broad idea. Okay, to fix things, I'm going to look at the two-way layout. Okay, so we have two factors, two covariates, and there's P1 levels of the first covariate and P2 levels of the second covariate. And so the model says we have observations, one or more observations, at a certain number of the covariate pair combinations. It may be an incomplete design, in which case we don't have an observation at every pair of the two covariate values. The covariate values themselves for the first covariate are the x1i, and for the second covariate, the x2j. Those are the values, or the possible values of those covariates. And we have observations at some of the pairs, x1i, x2j, and this subset B here basically identifies those cases. It could be a complete design, in which case B is just all the ij combinations. So we have here the regression problem with two covariates. That's an incomplete, typically incomplete scenario. We have here two-way layout in ANOVA, in which case the covariates are typically just labels, so they're nominal. There's a lot of, you know, scenarios buried within the notation here. And we have observational error, the EIJKs. And the point I want to make here is we're going to analyze things without assuming anything about those means beyond the fact that they depend on the covariates. So the function mu that maps the covariates into the m's is completely unknown. And I'll be analyzing procedures under that assumption. So there will never be a submodel assumption in analyzing how procedures work. And this is very much, of course, inspired by the point of view of Charles Stein from the 1950s onwards when he was estimating means without putting any assumptions on them. And that idea is very powerful and goes a long way. To do prove some theorems, we need some probability structure on the errors, and I'm just going to take what might be called a strong Gauss-Markov model, their IID, and have finite fourth moments. And that's pretty much it. Okay, so how are we going to estimate the means? Well, this is where it gets interesting. We don't know anything about the means, but we might have some suppositions, some prior conceptions on how the means might be behaving. And what we're going to do is hypothetically introduce those in order to construct a class of candidate estimators for the means. And then we're going to try to optimize over that class of candidate estimators, kind of adaptation. And so we'll just do that. And I'm going to have two data sets in mind which I'll use to illustrate. One, and both are well known, I think. The first one is from Noel Cressy's spatial statistics book. And what we have here is an attempt to do a coal ash assay. People are wondering where the coal is in the ground. They're pulling up cores and on a grid. And these cores are heated to a high temperature. And then the amount of coal ash remaining is measured. And that gives you an idea of how much coal was at that point. That's the idea. But what's interesting is that for reasons that probably have to do with geography, the places where you get observations where you actually get cores. These are the grid points observed here. Okay, you can see it's sort of an irregular design. It's almost complete within the interior there, but there is a missing value, which happens to be right here. And, you know, there's probably some good geographical reason for not having observations at some of those places. But this is the data we have, and the problem is to figure out how the amount of coal ash depends on location within the grid. And so here's a perspective plot. Up there at the top right, top left, is a perspective plot of the actual data. And if you look closely, there's one big peak there, which is a kind of outlier. And otherwise, they sort of wander around. And then there's some fits over there, which I'm going to lead up to. There's the adaptive fit that I'll get to, and then there's the extrapolation that gives you the whole regression function. That comes out of the technique used to get the adaptive fit. And so there's a couple of issues here which I'll have to address. One is the extrapolation in any sense sensible? And secondly, how did we get the adaptive fit and why? On what basis? Okay, so that's one data set. The other data set is, is the starch data. It's an ancient data set, and you'll find it replicated even in Chaffee. And what we have here is two factors. What we have is starch, different types of starch, seven kinds of starch. A little bit of water is added to each to get a sort of paste, and that paste is stretched until it breaks. And the response here is the thickness, is a strength, I think, the pulling strength that was necessary to make the film first break, and what's otherwise the two covariates of the starch type and the thickness of the film at which time it broke. Okay, so another interesting data set because it's a highly incomplete, it's a regression problem, basically. Where we have data, and so the covariate values here, the starch type and the thickness of the film at the time at which it broke, and you can see that they're all over the place, and it's a highly incomplete design. It's a two-way layout, but highly incomplete. Okay, and so how do you fit that? Well, classically, you do some kind of regression stuff. I want to go back to more basic principles in fitting this. And okay, so that's where we're headed. Now I have to set up the structure here. So I'm going to take this matrix of means in the two-way layout, and I'm going to think of all the possible means for which we have that are associated with covariate pair observations, even the ones that we haven't observed in any way, because we're trying to get at the regression function, and that means we need to have a mapping for over all possible covariate pairings. So I'm going to take the matrix of means in the associated complete design and vectorize them in the usual way, stack the columns, in other words. And that gives us a vector M. And because we have an incomplete, that vector M has dimension P, it's P by 1, but we don't necessarily have data at every for every mean, so we have Q means that are actually observed one or more times, and Q is less than or equal to P. So Q is the cardinality of the set of points at which we have data, set of covariate pairings. And then I introduced a notation that relates this complete design mean vector M to the vector M sub D, which is this collection, the subvector of means where we actually have some data. And it's just a simple mapping, it's a simple projection actually, of zeros and ones that takes us down to the subvector. And then we have one or more observations on the means where we do have observations. So I'm writing, it's a simple linear model, and I'm writing the expected value of y in this form. So the design matrix is being thought of as a product of two different matrices. You don't obviously have to do it that way, but it's useful to separate out two aspects. The D here tells you the nature of the incompleteness of the design. It maps, gives you the subvector where you have one or more observations, and C simply tells you what the replication pattern is once you have one or more observations. It's not necessary to do it that way, but I find it useful to separate those aspects in some of the theory that follows. So the problem is to estimate eta, or M sub D, given the data vector y, and it's also to extrapolate M sub D to M, that is to say the means where we don't have any data. That's the regression function aspect. And so there's a classical least squares procedure, which gives us an estimate for the expected value of y. It can be written in various ways, and C here, the design matrix where we have data, is non-singular, so it's a full rank, so there's no problem. C plus, which is the Moore-Penrose inverse, there's just C prime, C inverse, C prime there. Okay, we know that least squares is a lousy estimator in this situation because we typically don't have enough replication. So if we go back, for example, we go back, say, to this data set, the least squares estimator of the unknown means here is precisely the data itself because we have precisely one observation per covariate pairing. Now that's not very useful. Applied statisticians have responded to that for decades by fitting submodels of various kinds. These days, we have more techniques, and the one I'll be looking at is penalized least squares. And there are good theoretical reasons for doing something like that, because we know the least squares estimator is basically inadmissible here, thanks to Charles Stein's work in 56. Okay, so the instinct of the applied statisticians is dead right. In terms of pure decision theory, it's not a good idea to use least squares. The Gauss-Markov property is not good enough to give us a good estimator here, because Gauss-Markov restricts the competition to unbiased estimators and linear estimators, or at least Gaussian models. But it's the unbiasedness which is the killer. We have to do bias-variance trade-off. Okay, so we're going to do penalized least squares, but I'm going to allow myself, and it's really necessary in two-way and higher-way layouts, to have a number of penalty matrices floating around. So Q of T here is the overall penalty matrix. If you look at the middle here, this is the penalized least squares estimator of M in our linear model, which is Y equals CDM plus error. And we've got a quadratic penalty there. And Q of T is being constructed in a compound way in the display above. The key part is the linear combination of Q sub S's. And I'll be constructing Q sub S's so they penalize main effects and interactions in the two-way layout separately. Okay, and there's a lot of ways to do that, and that'll be part of the fun to figure out which ways to use. The epsilon, the small epsilon times the identity there, will be to force Q of T to be of positive definite, not just semi-definite, and we need that to do extrapolation, basically, in an incomplete layout. We don't need it. Let's say it's the best way I can think of to do it. So I need it. That's maybe the way to put it. Okay, so the calculation of the penalized least squares estimator is well known. It's basically in the category of ridge estimators, generalized ridge estimators that we get for M hat of T, this thing here. And then if we want to estimate the mean of Y, which is what this thing is, it's just CD times M hat of T, and you get this formula. Okay, the big question, of course, is the choice of the penalty weights and the penalty matrices. Yes? Small t is a penalty weight. T without any subscript, you mean? Oh, I see. D is the number of penalty terms. And in a two-way layout, in the examples I'll be looking at, it will be one penalty term for each of the two main effects and penalty term on the interaction, so D will be three in that case. But if you had a higher-way layout, of course, a three-way layout or whatever, you would have more. So the basic inspiration here is we're looking at penalizing separately the ANOVA decomposition. That's not the only way to use this stuff, but it's maybe the best way to start thinking about it anyway. It motivates things. You could be using various other bases and penalizing. The breakdown of the ANOVA breakdown is a projective breakdown. You can do other projective breakdowns, is what I'm saying. I think that'll become a little clearer later on, but at the moment, just think of ANOVA, because that is actually a useful case. Okay, there is a Bayes formulation to penalize least squares. It's been around for quite a while. It's quite useful because it leads us very easily to some other algebraic representations for the penalized least squares estimator. This algebraic identity here, which is really laborious to do by purely algebraic tools, is really obvious if you take the Bayes derivation of that particular estimator, because you just look at the induced prior on D at times M. Notice that I'm using, in the Bayes formulation, the possibility of Q inverse existing. So there's another reason for actually keeping Q positive definite. We're sort of guaranteeing admissibility by using a Bayes formulation with a Q inverse there. So anyway, we get the same formulae, and it's just another way of looking at the penalized least squares estimators. The main difference, though, is it really is, I'm looking at it within the model already described, and I'm not assuming normality in the errors. Okay, so what we're going to do is the idea of calculating the risk. We have these candidate estimators. Let's go back. So these are candidate estimators, and for the moment, I'm going to fix Q, the penalty matrix, which is actually a collection of penalty matrices, and I'm just going to think about the choice of the penalty weights. Okay, and so the idea that goes back to Stein is to look at the risk of each of these candidate estimators as T varies and estimate the risk. And what I've done here, forget about the object details, you can reduce the model to a canonical form, and in that canonical form you get a very nice expression for the risk, which is given over there. And you can do an estimated version of that risk, basically by doing a bias-corrected estimation of psi prime and putting in a consistent estimator of sigma hat squared. So this goes back to Mallow's CP and the great generalization of that in Charles Stein's 81 Annals paper, the Stein unbiased risk estimator. So this is just the particular application of all that to this scenario without invoking normality, but using the strong Gauss-Markov condition. So what we're going to do is the obvious thing, minimize estimated risk to pick T, and then try to figure out what that actually does for us in a theoretical sense. So that's the adaptation I'm talking about here. We're going to take the estimated risk, r hat of t, and minimize overall vectors of penalty weights. And I set things up, let's go back a little carefully here, well, wrong way. Notice that when I wrote down the penalty matrix Q of t, I put in that vector, that constant c on the right side, and that was simply so I could keep the penalty weights within 0, 1, each of them. Okay. I am going to keep them on the compact because in the end we're going to have to use some empirical process theory, and it'll basically be empirical process theory on C0, 1 to the D. That's what's in the background mathematically. So this is my way of getting into the C0, 1 to the D scenario. C could be 10 to the 8th or something, so it's not a big restriction in terms of practical calculations. Okay, some asymptotics here. So what we want to talk about is we're going to pick our penalty weights to minimize estimated risk. We're going to plug that into our, we're going to use that to pick the candidate penalized v-squared estimator for the expected value of y, and we're going to look at the actual risk of that and see what we can say about it. What we hope is that the adaptation here gives us an approximation to what you could call the Oracle estimator, which is to use the T that minimizes the actual risk. And the answer in general is, yeah, sometimes this happens and sometimes it doesn't, and what we want to have is some understanding of when it happens. So this is a particular result, stated slightly informally. There's two things going on. First of all, we want our estimator of the unknown variance to be consistent in an L1 sense, and that's the first assumption there under fact one. And that soup there is basically over balls in the space of means where signal-to-noise ratio is bounded by, okay? So we are sort of forming a compact there, but it can be a very large set. But you really need that in order to get the kind of results that we'll be talking about in the next display. And then we're going to look at either the loss or the risk of our candidate estimator, eta hat of t. Eta hat of t is the estimator of the expected value of y. Okay. There's other ways of formulating this, but this is the easiest to describe. And then the basic fact here is that the loss converges uniformly to the risk of the candidate estimator, uniformly over all t there, and so does the estimated risk. So the asymptotics here are quite interesting in that loss and risk converge together, actually, as the number of covariate value combinations goes to infinity. And this is the kind of asymptotics that I think was introduced, as far as I can tell, in the introduction to Charles Stein's 1956 paper. He was trying to motivate there what we later call, and what he developed more fully in 61, the James Stein estimator. And he has this wonderful geometric argument there, which is basically asymptotic. He doesn't draw the picture. Well, once you draw the picture, you see how really obvious it is. I mean, it was a very clever argument. But anyway, the key point was he was looking letting the number of means go to infinity in that argument. And that's what we're doing here, and it actually simplifies things to do that. Okay, so we have loss and estimated risk converging uniformly to true risk, and that's very useful because it means that we can use estimated risk as a plausible surrogate for the true risk. If you don't have uniformity, you know, you're dead. But we do have uniformity here. And as a result of that, we get what pretty much what you'd expect, you know, given the same consistency assumption on the variances, and then you can show that the risk of the adaptive estimator, eta hat of t hat, this is the quadratic risk, converges to the Oracle risk, r of t tilde, where t tilde is the smallest value of the risk over the candidate class of estimators. So in other words, adaptation is working the way we always hope, is doing the right thing asymptotically as the number of means go to infinity. What about the number of replications? Well, the only assumption here is that the number of replications is at least equal to the number of means. Okay, not assuming anything more than that. So this is not replication asymptotics, and it behaves quite differently from classical replication asymptotics of the type developed in the 60s. And we don't get the super efficiency phenomenon and so forth. We're stretching things out in a different way. Okay, so this tells us we should be able to use the adaptation technique and so forth and so on and do reasonably well, provided we have the scenario I've been describing. Okay, but there's still a big question. How do we pick those penalty matrices? So that was sort of a structural result that said for any fixed pedal penalty matrices, we know how to pick the penalty weights. But now we have to think about the penalty matrices themselves. And so we start, possibly, it's not the only thing we can do here, by thinking of the classical ANOVA decomposition of the means for a two-way layout. And that can be written in the form that M is the sum of four projections there. P naught of M is the projection on the, overall means. P1 of M is the projection on the factor 1 main effects. P2 of M does the factor 2 main effects. And P12 of M, those are the interactions. And those projections can be written very simply. And it's actually a lovely way to do analysis of variance on a computer. Why fool around with the classical algebraic formulas when you have these projections? So we're going to construct penalty matrices that are designed to work separately on the individual projections here. And that's the bottom display there. So I want my Q to operate on M in such a way that Q sub S operates on the projection P sub S of M. Okay. Now the P sub S could be something else other than the ANOVA decomposition. We could have a wavelet basis out there, or any kind of orthogonal basis, and we could be working with projections built up from that. So ANOVA is not the only scenario here, but it's a natural scenario to start with. And we want to take into account in constructing those Q sub S's, in addition, whether or not the covariate or factor that it's tied to is ordinal or nominal. Whether it's just a label or whether we might have some smoothness going on as we run through covariate values. So here's one general way of doing it. You think about annihilators, or what I call annihilators, and this is just a matrix in which the rows are contrasts. So when applied to the vector of ones, you get zero. That's what the first line there is saying. So we've got a matrix of contrast. So we could have a matrix, for example, which is the second difference matrix, and that would be an example of an annihilator. And that's something you might use if you have a ordinal factor and you want to do a little bit of smoothing maybe in your fit. I'll come to that. So anyway, this is a bit of mathematical motivation, and the point is that this kind of construction that's described there has its various ways of being viewed, and it has in particular the property that I've been looking for, that each of the penalty matrices work separately on the appropriate projection. Okay? And so ways of doing this, if both factors are two-way layout or nominal, it comes down, forget about what I've written here, it just comes down to using the ANOVA projections that I mentioned, or constructing them by choosing A sub R to be H sub R, and then the corresponding Qs are in fact the ANOVA projections. If you have two ordinal factors, you probably might consider doing some degree of smoothing. That's maybe step one. So you might choose your annihilator to penalize departures from local polynomial behavior of designated degree. And the D here is different from the D I had earlier. I'm sorry about that. And so, for example, difference operators do this. You have equally spaced covariate values. And you can generalize that with the help of orthogonal polynomials to work on unequal spacing. So that's all doable. And then you can mix these two strategies if you have one nominal factor, one ordinal factor. Let's see how this actually works. Go back to the collage data, where we had a geographical grid, equally spaced grid points, some missing, especially around the edges, and one in the middle. And if you look at the data, you actually think that maybe this doesn't vary too much. It looks like it might be locally constant even. So it's a natural thing to consider first difference operators in the penalty term. Okay, those penalize departures from constancy. There's no particular reason, unless, I'm not saying this is the only thing you have to do. You can explore other differences. We can have estimated risk for a whole range of scenarios, but the first one that comes to mind here is first difference operator. So you go through the business of risk and estimated risk. A big problem here is estimating variance, because we only have one observation per grid point where we do have data. And so you're going to have to tacitly impose some smoothness assumption in this scenario, as we do in nonparametric regression, in order to be able to estimate sigma squared. Replication is really a good idea, actually. That would be an honest way to do it, but we don't always have it. So here in this data set, in the literature, we don't have it. So I'm using a first differencing business to estimate sigma hat squared. Of course, it's a biased estimator. It's going to be biased upwards, and we don't have a knowledge of what the bias is. But on the other hand, we don't have anything else here. So this is, real life versus theory. You do have to estimate variance somehow. You can minimize estimated risk here, and we get about 0.117 as the estimated risk. And this is to be compared with the sigma hat squared. The sigma hat squared is actually the estimated risk of the naive least squares estimator, the data itself. So this little bit of smoothing that's being imposed by first difference penalty terms is actually doing a massive reduction in estimated risk. Okay? And the actual penalty weights here are the t hat vector, and what that is saying, if you interpret that, remember it's multiplied by a big C, which in this case was, what, do I have it recorded here? 10 to the fourth. So what this is saying is we penalize the daylights of the interaction term, and then we have your moderate penalization of the penalty terms corresponding to the main effects for both factors. Okay, so we're basically going to get an additive fit, a nearly additive fit here, but it's also smooth. There's two things going on. It's not just an ANOVA and additive fit. We put in some smoothing because of the penalization. And so that's what shows up when you look at the picture. The adaptive fit there is the estimated means at the points where we have data. And you can see it's an additive, it's basically an additive fit. There's no interaction visible to the eye. It's just additive effects from the two factors. The extrapolated fit, that's the regression function that's implied by the fitting technique that we use for the adaptive fit. And it's useful to understand what that extrapolation means. We can only compare our estimated, we can only assess risk or estimated risk at those data points, at those means where we have data. Okay, so the extrapolation is a what-if game. There's no way to assess whether or not it's a good thing. It's like extrapolation always is. It's a what-if game. If you fit a polynomial to some data, what happens between the data points is speculation, actually. Okay, and the same thing is going to be true of any extrapolation technique. But it's interesting to see how the extrapolation looks. It may be wrong. There may be a mountain at the corner of the grid there that we don't know about, in which case the coal ash, the geology might change. But that's, given what we have, that's a natural extrapolation. Interpolation is probably a safer bet, and we do have an interpolation there for the missing value at the grid point business. We have residuals, and you can see what they are. There's that one outlier that's visible at the far right of the lower plots. Okay, starch data. This is a different scenario, because here we have starch type, which is a nominal factor, a label, and then we have oh, I should say one more thing about the coal ash data. Of course, I tried second differencing, third differencing, and so forth in the penalization. They do worse than first differencing in terms of estimated risk. So you have a technique here for actually assessing the quality of your choices of penalty matrices. The starch data, it's a similar business, except one factor now is just a label. So we use the ANOVA-type projections for that, the generator for the ANOVA projections for that annihilator. And then I use second differences, which means locally penalizing towards local linear for the film thickness business, which is a continuous sort of covariate. You go through the whole routine again, and what you end up with here is a t hat. In this case, we actually have a bit of replication of data, so the sigma hat squared estimator could be based on those replicates, but there aren't enough, actually. So you end up combining that with some straight line fits to the starch to get a sigma hat squared. Again, it's an illustration of the fact that you really should try to get more data so you can get your variability estimated better. But we don't have it here. What the t hat means is that we're going to penalize out the interactions, and we're going to penalize out the overall mean term there, and we're going to retain in a sort of locally linear way, because of the way we constructed the annihilator, the one of the main effects. So that shows up in these plots here, and this is interesting because here you have this very sparse set of grid points at which we observe data. And now I'm forming the smallest set of grid points that contains these as subset, and this extrapolated fit is plotted over that larger grid. And we don't have data at most of the points, actually, but this is the regression function that the technique is generating. Now, how much we believe it, I think, I would be very careful here. You would want to know a lot more about the nature of the experiment and what they're asking and so forth. But mathematically, you get this extrapolation. There's other ways to look at it, which are also revealing. Here's separate plots for each starch. The data points are the little circles, the little X's are the extrapolated estimators. You can see that one of the starches, third one over in the top row, the data points are all over the place as you get to the right of the plot. So there's a big question to ask about the data there. It's not at all clear what's happening. Data seems confused. So that would be the first question to the experimenters, what happened there? And that reminds me of something that David Brillinger once said years ago in Berkeley. He said, the purpose of a statistical analysis is to help the experimenter construct a refined experiment for the next time. The statistician is the one who brings out the issues, and then the experimenter can get back down to finding out what's really happening. So there we have one issue. Okay, I want to relate this to some other things that have happened with penalized least squares. And so I'm going to look now at a one-way layout. I'll get to that later. I'm going to look here at the scenario we're looking at, specialized to the case where the penalty matrices Q sub S are just mutually orthogonal projections. And I'm going to assume that the design is complete and balanced, so that we have n-naught observations at each mean. And then the algebra simplifies enormously, and you find that the candidate estimators m hat of t have the form in the second last display, and abstractly it's basically just a weighted sum of the projections of the classical least squares estimator. Okay, so it's a shrinkage estimator because those weights are between 0 and 1. So it's multiple shrinkage applied to the mean vector. And you can think of this in a two-way layout, in which case those projections would be the four ANOVA projections, say, in the two-way layout. And then you can go through the routine of calculating estimated risk, minimizing it, and that can all be done algebraically here. And after a bit of work, you realize, good grief, I've seen this before. What you get here after the algebra is positive part James-Stein shrinkage of each of the projections of the means, each of the ANOVA projections. It's not quite James-Stein, because Stein refined things under the normal model. Instead of having P there, he had P minus something, right? And that improves risk slightly in an exact analysis. And that's a whole different game. But it's an improvement that disappears very rapidly as P increases. So for the kinds of data sets we encounter these days with many covariate values, it's a very small improvement, and it depends on normality. So that's another issue altogether. The point I want to make is that Stein actually did this in 1966. A different approach. He wasn't looking at estimated risks, but he was looking at multiple shrinkage, something he'd mentioned in the 56 paper, worked it through, published it in the Neyman Festschrift that F.N. David edited, and it's been pretty thoroughly ignored by anybody teaching ANOVA since then. And it's really stupid, I have to say, to ignore it, because the usual routine when we teach ANOVA is to run F-tests on the main effects and interactions and so forth. What Stein's procedure does is it just gives you shrinkages on each of those projections. And if the shrinkage factor is very small, that's telling you right off that interaction or main effect is not important. And if it's close to 1, well, it's important. And the point is, you get this in one global calculation. You're not running multiple F-tests and then worrying about what the effect of running multiple F-tests is and so forth. It's an estimation point of view, and you're just controlling risk of your fit and trying to find better risk than the classical least squares. It works beautifully. I have a lab in one of the courses I teach where we try this out on classical data sets. It's magnificent. It's a real pity it's been ignored. Okay, we can do other things and relate things to other things. I've looked at penalty matrices where we just have annihilators defining the Q sub S's, and you can complicate that scenario. You can replace an annihilator matrix by a family of annihilator matrices, so bring in another level of adaptation. And I'm doing this here for the one-way layout, so the AA prime, it would be the Q sub 1, I guess, in the one-way layout that I talked about earlier, constructed from an annihilator. And the idea here is to construct a family of annihilators, A sub theta, by forming linear combinations of specific annihilators, which could be first differences, second differences, and so forth. And once you start thinking about that, you realize, there's been stuff out there in that direction, too. And so in particular, if you look at the work that Jim Ramsey's been involved in, and there's a whole bunch of papers, he's doing penalized V-squares in the area of functional data analysis, and his, what I call annihilators, in his case, are derivatives, differential operators. And, you know, he's forming linear combinations of those. He's putting classes of differential equations, in other words, into the penalty term. Well, this is the discrete version of that. Okay, this construction of annihilators. And you can carry out the asymptotics I've discussed because this enlargement here still leaves us within the class of candidate estimators that are symmetric linear estimators. And so the theory, the asymptotic theory for that is the number of covariate levels goes to infinity, still carries through, and everything works theoretically. And perhaps more importantly, because we've already looked at a two-way layout, we can see that we can do this kind of differential operator stuff, not just in one-way regression scenarios, but in multiple ways. You can have multiple covariates and be working with differential operators in all directions, and including interaction terms and so forth. So the whole unexplored territory on what these things actually carry out in practice, you know, what they do for us in practice, that takes case studies. The point I'm making is that mathematically we are encouraged to look at that. This is going to work, theoretically. Okay, and another direction you can go in, which is of course tempting, is to say, we've been talking about univariate responses. What happens if we have h-dimensional responses? So we have a linear model again, y equals cdm. Y now is the data matrix with h columns. And we have an error term, which I've written structurally as v times sigma to the 1/2, because there may be covariances within the components of the h-dimensional observation vector. But otherwise, it's pretty much the same structure. The question is, how do you penalize in a case like this? And I'm not going to go through the thought process that led to what I've written down here in the bottom of transparency. The point is, you do something quadratic, but now, and you still have penalty matrices Q sub S, but the new thing is that instead of penalty weights now, instead of weighting them with the T's, as I call them, we're going to weight with symmetric matrices, whose eigenvalues lie between 0 and 1, actually. Okay, those are the N sub S's there. So the new thing that comes up is that instead of just doing scalar weighting of penalty terms, we are now well advised to do affine weighting from the right. That's what the N sub S's do. And what happens, I stumbled across this through a long indirect process, and the original point I stumbled across after doing it all and wondering why I recognize the results sort of is this. Suppose we just have a one-way layout and the penalty matrix Q sub 1, so D is equal to 1. The penalty matrix is just the identity matrix. And then if we work out the penalization there, what you actually get is, for large P, essentially the F and Morris estimator, shrinkage estimator. And what's going on, actually, if you look into the precise algebra there, is you're transforming coordinate system, then doing scalar shrinkage, and then transforming back. That's what the penalization by the N sub S's do. Now, you're not limited to, you know, the F and Morris scenario. You're not limited to balanced scenarios, which is what F and Morris was designed for, or balanced complete. Everything we talked about for incomplete and unbalanced designs is doable here. There's algorithmic issues. I don't want to minimize those. I don't have good algorithms for doing this over a whole bunch of N sub S's. But theoretically, we have the same kinds of results that I've been describing, that adaptation is going to work over those N sub S's as well as the Q sub S's. I should mention, I didn't tell you where those two theorems came from. And what's going on in the background, because you want these uniform convergences, is, of course, modern empirical process theory. That's how you prove uniformity over an index set. In that case, it was pretty elementary because I had T in 0, 1. So your classical convergence over C, 0, 1 to the D does the job. So that's a relatively elementary argument. It's very easy to get into scenarios, and one paper that I got into this was with Lutz-Dumkin, where we were estimating, we're doing monotone shrinkage, unconstrained monotone shrinkage over a whole bunch of projections. The projections equal the number of covariates, actually. And then you have to get into the modern empirical process theory. But that's the main tool in proving the asymptotics here. Okay, just a few ideas. Some of the old ideas that are floating around here, I've talked about penalized base pairs specifically. But one of the things that's implicit here is that we're not assuming away the possibility of interactions. Modern non-parametric regression tends to work with purely additive models or models with simple interactions thrown in. And that's not necessary. You can actually let the data speak to that, tell you which interactions to hang in with and which ones to throw out. That's the whole point of the shrinkage business, to identify the important interactions. So we can be a little more ambitious when trying to deal with multicovariate regression than using additive models. Then we have, of course, the issue that's come up in some of the examples that we need to estimate sigma squared. And really, there's no good substitute for replication, because anything else requires imposing some assumptions on those unknown means. And okay, it's better than nothing if the assumptions happen to be more or less correct, but Fisher told us to replicate, and I don't think you can argue with that. And then we have a long-standing practice to fit simplified models. So when we teach regression, we have them fit lines and parabolas and so forth. But that's a primitive start on a deeper thought, which is to do some form of regularization to control risk. And that's Stein's main contribution, I think, to the discussion. And so that's the classical background. And where we are now, I think, is that we have a whole bunch of adaptive penalized least squares methodologies. They come from various sources, and each of the sources is interesting because they're motivated by different data types. And so we learn something. So what Jim Ramsey, for example, did with differential operators in the penalty terms can be seen as a way of constructing classes of annihilators over which we can do adaptation. So there's a lot of stuff out there. Everything here has been for quadratic penalties. I haven't lassoed anything. And my point is that we haven't even finished exploring the quadratic case. And it's a case worth exploring because you can go further algebraically in it. Okay, so I'm going to quit at this point, I think. What else did I have? Yeah, that's it. So thank you for surviving all that. There's a bit too much algebra there, I realize, but sorry.